Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, September 18th, 2020. I'm the reader, Alan Fredergill. Here's a look at what I'll be reading today. First, I'll take a look at the weather, then the mini editorial, then front page and inside stories of local interest. About 20 minutes after the hour, I'll read letters to the editor and editorials. Then at about 30 minutes past the hour, I'll read the obituaries. After that, it'll be feature stories, sports, and other stories as time allows. First, here's the weather, and then the mini editorial. Well, it's going to be cooler today, 70 degrees. A little cloudy, winds southeast at 7 to 14 miles an hour, 52 tonight with some more wind. And Saturday is partly cloudy, 77, and Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, 80, 82, and 85. Nighttime lows almost the same, 57 or 58 every single day. No rain in the forecast anywhere for the next 5 days at least. So the sun rose this morning at 7:09 a.m. and it'll set tonight at 7:29 p.m. 3 minutes difference. Actually, it looks like two. Tomorrow, 7:10 a.m. sunrise, 7:28 p.m. sunset. Well, here's the mini editorial. This comes from Peggy Mosney of South Sioux City. Just wondering, she says, is the United States the only victim of global warming, or are there raging fires and damaging storms around the world too? Haven't heard a word on television, on radio, newspapers, or on social media about any of this. Now, that's from Peggy Mosney again of South Sioux City. Now for the lead story. The Iowa Supreme Court has denied the appeal from Woodbury County over the mail ballot applications. The Iowa Supreme Court on Wednesday denied an appeal by the Woodbury County Auditor's Office, affirming a district court ruling that previously received mail ballot requests for the November election were invalidated, so people who wanted such ballots will have to begin the process over. Auditor Pat Gill, in a Thursday release, said he would comply with the court decision, which in essence affirmed the ruling in late August by District Court Judge Patrick Cott, who granted a temporary injunction against the auditor's office and invalidated thousands of absentee ballot requests. Cott ruled that Gill's office will have to send letters to registered Woodbury County voters informing them the absentee ballot request forms sent by his office are invalid and that they will have to fill in another blank absentee ballot request if they wish to vote by mail. Of the 57,000 ballot request forms that were sent out, more than 15,000 had returned to date, Gill said Thursday in updating the number. The legal battle began in August when President Donald Trump's re-election campaign, in an effort to suppress the vote, along with the Republican National Committee, the Republican Party of Iowa, the National Republican Senatorial Committee, and the National Republican Congressional Committee, took Gill's office to court over the absentee ballot request forms that were sent to registered voters. At issue was the fact that the absentee ballot request forms had been sent with key voter information, such as names, dates of birth, and voter PIN numbers, which few voters have memorized, filled in. Well, that's a shocking crime, isn't it? The voter had only to verify that the information was correct, sign the request for a ballot, and mail it back to Gill's office, which seems like a reasonable thing to do. However, the Trump campaign, which again tried to suppress votes by filing identical lawsuits in Linn and Johnson counties in Iowa, argued that the county auditors had violated a directive from Republican Secretary of State Paul Pate, who told local officials last month that the forms must be mailed blank to voters in order to ensure uniformity across Iowa's 99 counties. Judge Tott ruled that Gill's office must obey Pate's directives and orders. While there are certainly very good reasons for why people will want to vote by absentee ballot in light of the ongoing COVID situation, in addition to all the traditional reasons why persons want to vote absentee, if certain voters do not understand or request a new absentee ballot, their ability to vote has not been prevented. They still have the opportunity to vote in person on election day or any time during the early voting period, Cott wrote in his ruling. In upcoming days, Gill said Thursday, voters who have submitted the now invalidated forms will receive a notification with a blank absentee form along with a postage paid envelope, encouraging the voter to resubmit the absentee request form so that a new ballot can be sent for the election. That mailing will go out on October 5th, which is also the first day for early in-person voting, which will be available starting that day at the Long Lines Family Rec Center in downtown Sioux City. Gill said he is working with the City of Sioux City and Sioux City School District to finalize polling places for all 44 county precincts. Gill said no county money was used to fund the appeal. He said the costs were paid by the League of United Latin American Citizens of Iowa, a group that was an intervening appellant in the case. In early September, Gill expressed concern that his office budget may be strained by dealing with improperly filled out absentee ballot requests. He estimated the process could cost his office more than $30,000, more than half of all the money he had budgeted for election staff. A second article from the front page of the Journal today is that the city's first bike lane has been opened, and it's reserved for biking. It's on Leech Avenue. Located between Fairmont and Ruston Streets, Sioux City's first bicycle lane officially opened on Thursday, and avid cyclist Ron Bagnosh was ecstatic. Hopefully this will encourage people we bike to bike instead of driving a car, Bagnosh, ride coordinator with the Siouxland Cycles, said before going for a ride. However, longtime cyclist Bob DeSchmidt noted Sioux City was by far the largest community in Iowa that didn't have bicycle lanes. We definitely needed one for a very long time, he said. Mayor Pro Tem Dan Moore was in complete agreement. Bike lanes are a quality of life consideration, Moore said. When people consider moving, they often ask how bike-friendly a city is. This is why the council decided to add bike lanes as part of the city's Leech Avenue reconstruction project. In addition to bike lanes, the first phase of the $1.3 million project included replacing all street pavings, sidewalks, driveway entrances, water mains, sanitary sewers, and storm sewers from South Fairmont Street to South Ruston. The next phase of this project will continue these reconstructions along South Ruston Street to Leech Avenue to Dodge Avenue in fiscal 2023, followed by Dodge from South Ruston to South Cecilia Street in fiscal 2024, and finally, South Cecilia to Dodge to Morningside Avenue, slated for completion in 2025. Each of these projects are expected to include bike lanes as well as other reconstruction improvements, Moore said. Bagnosh is simply happy that the new bike lane means progress for cyclists like himself. Sioux City will soon open its second lane on resurfaced part of Riverside Boulevard, which is slated to open this fall. And that is a step in the right direction, he said. Cycling is such a family-friendly activity that we should make it as accessible for as many people as possible. Indeed, that was why Ashford Malloy got involved with the Siouxland Cyclists. I've only been riding a bike for a couple of years, said Malloy, a Western Iowa Tech Community College business student. I'm originally from the East Coast and lived in a town that didn't have any cycling organizations. I like cycling for the fitness aspect as well as for the friends I've made, he added. There are several articles, photographs accompanying this article. This one that I'm looking at shows Jerry Probst as he leads a group of cyclists down Leech Avenue following a ceremony commemorating the opening of a bike lane near the intersection of South Fairmont Street and Leech Avenue in Sioux City on Thursday. Turning now to page A3 of the journal, headline reads, Coronavirus cases take a jump in Sioux City metro area. The number of novel coronavirus positive tests rose Thursday in the metro area as cases climbed more sharply than in recent days in Woodbury and Dakota counties. Additionally, the equivalent of 1/6 of all cases reported over the 6 months in Wayne County, Nebraska, popped up in one day with 22 new positive virus cases, taking their total to 119. The number of positive cases in Woodbury County have gone up by a combined 225 over the last 4 days, including the largest single-day increase in some time, with 87 on Thursday. In Dakota County, the recent number of new positives had been in the low single digits, including only one new case earlier this week, while the Thursday total was 25 new cases. The Siouxland District Health Department, in a Facebook post, cited the 87 cases as part of a notable trend. Woodbury County has been seeing a significant increase in COVID-19 cases recently. These cases are not a concentrated blurb in any specific age or population demographic. All age ranges are represented in our case counts, indicating significant spread in the community, the post said. In Woodbury County, 4,761 people have tested positive for the virus since March, and 59 people have died. The aggregate number of cases is 2,107 and 43 deaths in Dakota County. It's extremely important that everyone do their part to prevent the spread by staying home when sick, even if only mildly ill, physically distancing, wearing masks in public, and washing hands frequently, the SDHT Post said. There were two deaths from COVID-19 reported in Siouxland on Thursday. One was in O'Brien County, taking their total to 9, and one was in Union County, South Dakota, where 6 people have now died from COVID-19. There have been more than 110 new cases in O'Brien County over the last 2 days combined. For most people, the coronavirus causes only mild or moderate symptoms, such as fever and cough. For some, however, especially older adults and people with existing health problems, it can cause more severe illness, including pneumonia, and can lead to death. The vast majority of people recover from the new virus. According to the World Health Organization, people with mild cases recover in about 2 weeks, while those with more severe ones can take up to 6 weeks to get better. The state of Iowa is now closing in on 78,000 cases, and the governor still will not issue a mask mandate. Again, from page A3, a business survey has revealed that the economy is improving in 10 rural states. The economy in rural parts of 10 plains and western states is seeing some improvement, but remains weak, according to a new monthly survey of bankers in the region. Rural Main Street Survey's overall index remained negative at 46.9 in September, even though it improved from August 44.7 and marked several straight months of continued improvement since March, when the index bottomed out for the year at 35.5 as the coronavirus pandemic emerged. Any score below 50 suggests a shrinking economy, while a score above 50 suggests a growing economy. So we're still shrinking. More bankers showed optimism about the economy's outlook over the next 6 months, with the survey's confidence index rising to 50 from August 44.6. Recent improvements in agriculture commodity prices, federal stimuli, and Federal Reserve record low interest rates have underpinned the rural Main Street economy, said Creighton University economist Ernie Goss, who oversees the survey. Bank CEOs estimated that farm income, including government support, was down only 1.5% from this time last year. But fewer than 1 in 4 bankers reported that their local economies were back to levels that they were before the outbreak. Bankers from Colorado, Illinois, Iowa, Kansas, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming were included in the survey. Farmland prices declined to 45 in September from August's 50, while the farm equipment sales index slipped from 32.8 in August down to 32.1 now. We've got some briefs from page A5 of the journal. Lamar's fires one of its policemen over social media posts. The Lamar's Police Department has fired a police officer over misconduct related to social media activity. The Lamar's Police Department said it was aware of concerning social media posts made by Officer Jeremy Singer early Sunday morning. He was placed on immediate administrative leave per department policies. Following an investigation, Singer was relieved of his duties Tuesday. Based on the results of the misconduct investigation, Singer was dismissed as a City of Lamar's police officer. Lamar's Police Chief Kevin Vandevette said in a statement, "The City of Lamar's took this matter seriously, and the actions and comments made by Singer are not representative of the values in place to ensure that there is trust between the police department and the community of Lamar's." They don't say what the comments were. Sioux City Police are investigating a shooting. Police are continuing to investigate a report of shots fired in a mid-city neighborhood late Wednesday afternoon. Approximately 4:35 p.m. yesterday, an unknown male exited the passenger side of a vehicle in the 1500 block of Jones Street, firing at least 2 shots from a handgun towards the northwest, Sioux City Police said. Bullet holes were found on the front of 2 homes that were occupied at the time. Nobody inside either home was injured. The suspects fled the area south on Jones Street. The motive of the shooting is unknown, police said. And officials are worried that Iowa won't meet long-term test rules for long-term care facilities. House Democrats expressed concern that Iowa's COVID-19 testing program at long-term care facilities set out by Governor Kim Reynolds' administration will not be able to meet the requirements spelled out under revised federal guidelines to prevent outbreaks among staff and residents. Legislative Democrats made public a letter from the State Department of Public Health and State Hygienic Laboratory to long-term care partners in Iowa, indicating state facilities likely could not provide testing services for surveillance purposes until the Federal Health and Human Services Agency supplied rapid point-of-care diagnostic testing supplies and equipment to Iowa's facilities. State health officials say they have partnered with long-term care centers in COVID-19 testing and will continue to do so, but they noted that the volume and frequency generated by the new federal requirement for routine staff testing on top of current testing will exceed the state hygienic lab's capacity. Therefore, the state hygienic lab will be unable to provide and process routine tests for Iowa's long-term care facility staff members for the purposes of complying with the federal rule, the letter said. If facilities are unable to meet the new federal testing requirements due to lab availability, supply shortages, or other reasons until the promised supplies and equipment arrive, state officials said in the letter, they're instructed to document their attempts to perform and/or obtain testing in accordance with the guideline. This letter is intended to serve as documentation that neither the state hygienic lab, the Iowa Department of Public Health, nor county public health departments in Iowa can provide testing services for surveillance purposes, as outlined under the new federal provision. The state hygienic lab will continue to provide testing support for symptomatic staff, residents, close contacts of cases, and when workers with public health and long-term care facilities, if positive cases are identified, the letter added. In a news release, Representative Tim Brown, Brown Powers, a Democrat from Waterloo, expressed concern that the Reynolds administration officials were informing long-term care facilities they are unable to provide routine testing to prevent outbreaks at the centers at a time when Iowa has 39 such outbreaks with 925 positive cases, and 657 of Iowa's 1,248 COVID-19 deaths have occurred at long-term care facilities. More Iowans will die as a result of this terrible decision, Brown Powers said. Instead of expanding testing to prevent outbreaks and keep Iowans safe, Governor Reynolds is moving us backward and starting to ration COVID tests used to protect our most vulnerable in nursing homes and those in the front lines. More than 6 months into this pandemic, we should be testing thousands more, not less, Brown Powers added. Iowa is already a world hotspot for COVID, and this change will make it worse. This is a complete failure by the Reynolds and Trump administrations to prevent outbreaks and stop the spread of COVID. Reynolds spokesman Pat Garrett said the information in the House Democrats' news release is not accurate, but didn't say what it was. The state of Iowa has and will continue to be a leader in testing, they claimed. IDPH and SHL continue to test in facilities when staff or residents become symptomatic and when positive cases are identified, Garrett claimed. New federal guidelines requiring routine testing for staff could generate more than 130,000 tests per week in addition to the significant testing that's already underway. He said the increase will exceed the department's capacity and is why the state will only need to rely on incoming federal support. As the letter noted, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services intensify rapid point-of-care diagnostic tests, supplies, and equipment to long-term care facilities in Iowa. About 20 minutes past the hour, so we'll read an opinion editorial from the opinion page. It's titled, Bad Cops, Protesters Who Cheer Violence Are Both Enemies. The ambush shooting of two Los Angeles sheriff's deputies Saturday was a savage crime utterly outside the realm of legitimate debate about police brutality. Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden was right to quickly and forcefully condemn this vicious act, and importantly, to condemn the anti-police demonstrators who mobbed the hospital where the officers were taken, blocking entrance while at least one yelled, "We hope they die." Those who express such venom, like those who loot and burn, are no better than police who abuse their power. Biden must continue saying that, loudly and often, to thwart President Donald Trump's cynical strategy of painting legitimate protesters and opportunistic criminals with the same broad brush. The May 25th killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police has prompted what feels like a turning point in America's long, fraught struggle with racial justice and police reform. Black Lives Matter has become a mainstream sentiment, despite attempts by Trump and others to represent it as a radical. polls show that strong majorities of white Americans finally recognize that police brutality is a serious issue and that black Americans are more likely to be victims of that brutality. They're right. A recent Harvard study found that blacks, on average, are three times as likely as whites to be killed during police contact. Most of the protests against police brutality that have arisen around the country in recent months have been peaceful, but small factions have committed violence out of self-indulgent anger or have used the events as cover for looting and wanton mayhem. Either way, they undermine the legitimate protests and aid those who oppose the reform movement. A still unknown assailant who walked up to a parked squad car in Los Angeles early Saturday evening and gunned down the two deputies where they sat is every bit as monstrous as the officers who killed Floyd. The two young deputies, one of them a mother of a six-year-old, were in critical but stable condition Tuesday and were expected to survive. The protesters who mobbed the hospital not only displayed their inhumanity, but risked others by blocking entrances. These are not the allies any serious reformer should want, ever. They are enemies of the police reform movement, every bit as much as Trump himself, because they tar what is fundamentally an anti-violence campaign with violence. Trump and his followers love to obfuscate such nuances, and no wonder. It is the nature of prejudice to categorize people into broad groups whose causes can be easily designated and denigrated and dehumanized. Bad cops dehumanize when they treat black people differently. Protesters dehumanize when they cheer the shooting of two deputies they knew nothing about. Bigotry isn't just about race. It's about casting judgment based on ignorance and broad brush characterizations rather than allowing empathy to prevail over hatred. Okay, here's a story from the sports page. Sioux City's Draco Rodriguez gets UFC contract. Draco Rodriguez didn't go to Las Vegas to talk. He didn't go down there to brag about his skills. He didn't go there to get in the face of his opponent in the pre-bout weigh-in. The Sioux City MMA fighter went to Las Vegas to win a fight and earn a UFC contract during Dana White's UFC Contender Series on September 8th. Rodriguez sticked to his game plan in what ended up being an impressive fight for the 24-year-old. His opponent, Mana Martinez, tried for an Umaplata arm lock when the two were on the mat, but Rodriguez fought it off and got in a triangle chokehold. That proved to be the end of the bout. Martinez never tapped, but he did go limp from Rodriguez's hold, giving Rodriguez the 135-pound bantamweight win by a submission TKO in 222 on ESPN+. Rodriguez got up and yelled, "I need that contract, Dana." UFC President Dana White took notice and was impressed with Rodriguez's performance. After Rodriguez's win, White offered Rodriguez a four-fight UFC contract. "It feels good. Now that a week has passed, I can't believe it," Rodriguez said. "It does feel surreal. It means to me I just have to work harder. I want to thank my coach, Brett Welling." White was so impressed with Rodriguez that he almost put him on the UFC 253 card later this month at Fight Island. UFC 253 is scheduled for Saturday, September 26th, and is headlined by the middleweight fight between Israel Adesanya and Paulo Costa. But Rodriguez's first official UFC fight will have to wait, since there was a slight hiccup in being able to add him to the UFC 253 card. "We're thinking like maybe we might fight in 3 months, and I would take some time to work on my wrestling, my kicks, my jiu-jitsu, but they offered me the fight on the UFC 253 card," Rodriguez said. "Then they asked if I had a passport, and I don't, so I couldn't fight. I'm working on getting my passport, and they know that, and hopefully they want me for the next one." Rodriguez not only impressed White with his performance in the octagon, but also because of how he learned about UFC. When Rodriguez was about 13 or 14, he was watching WWE Monday Night Raw with his uncle, who turned the channel to Spike TV, which was showing old UFC fights with Chuck Liddell. Rodriguez fell in love with the UFC right away, and has said in interviews how those fights influenced him. White was impressed Rodriguez brought up Spike TV, which is now Paramount TV. "Dana liked my personality. He talked to one of his partners and said, 'This kid talked about Spike.' He's been waiting for someone to say that," Rodriguez said. "That's why they put the reruns on then." Maybe a kid would grow up watching those. I got to talk with Dana and everything. Rodriguez might have spent more time with White than he did in the octagon. Rodriguez came into the bout with a 6-1 record under the training of Welling, who couldn't be in Las Vegas for the fight. Welling taught Rodriguez his striking, and Woodbury Central grad Nathan Ryan taught him how to wrestle effectively. Martinez also came in with a 6-1 record, and Rodriguez was preparing for a bloody fight, one that could go the distance. But in 222, Rodriguez put Martinez to sleep with the strangled chokehold. He wanted to knock me out any way he could. He wanted to go through me. He was buying into his own hype, Rodriguez said. The only bad thing is, I said, his dream is going to the UFC. He's going to keep dreaming because I'm going to get the contract before him. I didn't want to say all that bad stuff and end up losing because I would be the one to look bad. Rodriguez's social media blew up after the win. He noticed his Instagram account, which is Draco Rodriguez, grew in followers, and he was getting a good amount of mentions on Twitter, which is Draco Rodriguez 22. Rodriguez is back in Sioux City as he works on getting his passport and prepping for his first UFC fight. He'll continue to work with Welling, but Rodriguez is also looking to expand his training as well. I'd have to go out of town and find some new places to train, find people that are in my same situation. I want to grow as a fighter, Rodriguez said. I just can't be fighting people in town, but I still want to be here, maybe half and half. I still have Brett here, and he's helped me get in this position. Brett and I have a good thing together. You're listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, September 18th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First one comes from Quimby, Iowa. Donald O. Todd, 93, died Tuesday, September 15th. Services are private at the graveside with military rites. There will be no public visitation, but arrangements are with Boothby Funeral Home in Cherokee. From Ida Grove, Iowa, Darlene E. Lansing, 79, died Wednesday, September 16th. Arrangements are pending with Christensen Van Houten Funeral Home in Ida Grove. From Stamford, Connecticut, Frederick Charles McClure, M-A-C-C-L-U-R-E, 67, died Thursday, June 18th. Services are September 22nd at 10:30 a.m. at St. John Catholic Church in Ottawa. Burial will be after the service at the Ottawa Cemetery. Visitation is September 22nd from 9 to 10:30 a.m. at the church. Social distancing measures must be followed. Family asks attendees to bring and wear masks. Arrangements are with the Rush Family Care Service of Ottawa. From Sioux City, Dolores A. Blades, 89, died Sunday, September 13th. Services are today, September 18th at 10:30 a.m. at Wesley United Methodist Church. Burial will be in Graceland Park Cemetery in Sioux City. Visitation is today. It's already happened. 9:30 until service time at the church. Social distancing guidelines and masks will be required. Services will also be broadcast on radio channel FM 100.5. Arrangements are with the Boothby Funeral Home in Cherokee. From Ottawa, Esther Magdalene McClure, 94, died Wednesday, September 16th. Services are again today at 10:30 at St. John Catholic Church in Ottawa, and burial will be after the service at the Ottawa Cemetery. Visitation is today. It's already happened. Social distancing measures must be followed, according to the Rush Family Care Service of Ottawa. And from Tyconic, Iowa, Raymond J. Bennett, B-E-N-N-E-T-T, 77, died Tuesday, September 15th. A private service will be held. Arrangements are with the Rush Family Care Service of Ottawa. From Sioux City, Randall D. Dunagan, D-U-N-A-G-A-N, 65, died Thursday, September 17th. Arrangements are pending with the Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. And from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, Curtis Herman Miller, Reverend Curtis Herman Miller, 73, died peacefully at home, surrounded by his family, on Tuesday, September 15th in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. A private service for the family will be held at 1 p.m. on Saturday, September 19th. The service will be live-streamed through the Facebook page of Olson Funeral Home in Menominee, Wisconsin, or it may be viewed at a later date. To share a memory, please visit obituaries at www.olsonfuneral.com. Curtis was born on May 3, 1947, in Lamars, to Herman and Vernon Miller. He was raised on the family farm and graduated from Remsen Union High School in 1965. He attended Wartburg College, graduating in 1969. On June 2, 1969, he married Cheryl Vandertuig of Lamar's, and they raised three sons, Eric, Nathan, and Paul. Kurt graduated from Wartburg Theological Seminary in 1973 with a Master of Divinity degree, and he was ordained on July 1, 1973 at St. John's Lutheran Church in Lamar's. His first call was to Holy Trinity Lutheran of Dubuque, Iowa. From 1975 to 1982, he served at St. Paul Lutheran in Tama, Iowa. From 82 on, he became an assistant to the Bishop of the Iowa District of the American Lutheran Church, and the family moved to Storm Lake. In 1987, at age 40, Kurt was elected the first bishop of the Western Iowa Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and he served in that capacity for 14 years. While he was a bishop, he served on numerous boards, including Waldorf College, Lutheran Social Services of Iowa, and the Ecumenical Ministries of Iowa, as well as the ELCA Church Council. Kurt and Cheryl were able to travel around the United States, to Europe several times, and to Tanzania, Africa, to visit the Companion Synod of Western Iowa. After his service as bishop, he served Christ Lutheran Church in Cottonwood, Minnesota, from 2001 to 2007. Kurt and Cheryl retired due to his increasing health problems and moved to Eau Claire in order to be near family. Kurt showed grace and courage in the face of increasing physical challenges. He loved his God, his family, Christ Church, and his many friends. Memorials may be directed to the Reverend Curtis and Cheryl Endowed Scholarship at Wartburg Theological Cemetery, 333 Wartburg Place, Dubuque, 52003, Spirit Lutheran, or Eau Claire, or a charity of your choice. From Anthon, Iowa, Ashley L. Clausen-Wilson, 28, died Tuesday, September 15th. Services are tomorrow, September 19th, at 10 a.m. at Salem Lutheran Church in rural Correctionville. Visitation is September 18th from 5 to 7 at Rhodey Funeral Home in Kingsley. It resumes 1 hour prior to the service at the church. And from Sioux City, Geneva Remillard Flannery, 91, of Sioux City, passed away Monday, September 14th at her home. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday at Cathedral of the Epiphany, St. Boniface Church, with Father Esquiliano, a celebrant. Burial will be at Calvary Cemetery. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the service time with a rosary at 9:30 a.m. Due to the ongoing pandemic, masks will be required at the church. Arrangements are under the direction of Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Online condolences can be left on its website. Geneva was born December 17, 1928, the daughter of Charles and Anna Hickey Remillard. She grew up in Sioux City and graduated from Cathedral High School in 1946. On September 5, 1958, she married Richard Flannery at St. Boniface Catholic Church, and they had three children, Geneva and Dick loved to dance and first met at Shore Acres Ballroom. Geneva was a divisional secretary to Telly Worley at Investors Diversified Services. She also worked at Conservative Bond and Mortgage Company, Woodbury County Treasurer's Office, and the Catholic Education Office. Geneva was a homemaker, raising her three kids during many of Dick's deployments, including 1 year in Vietnam. She also lovingly babysat four of her grandchildren full-time for 30 years. Geneva was a devout Catholic, often reciting the rosary that was a wedding gift from her husband, Dick. She was also a devoted supporter of Bishop Heelan High School. Geneva was proud to be present at the first candlelight march for life in Sioux City in 1973. She marched fearlessly around St. Luke's Hospital in the cold January weather. Geneva felt being a mom was her greatest blessing. She attended many musicals, ballets, and baseball games. Geneva was a talented cook. She loved to shop and to drive her Buick station wagon, appropriately nicknamed the Sherman Tank. She enjoyed sharing her birth year with Mickey Mouse and her birthday with Pope Francis. When Geneva became immobile for the last 5 years, Richard and daughter Kathy cared for her in the comfort of their own home. Dick preceded Geneva in death on January 5th of this year. Memorials will be directed by the family to an organization of their choice at a later date. And there's a new golf course that's slated for Northeast Nebraska. It's the Landman Golf Club near Homer, and it will be a marquee course, they say. About a year from now, one of the most fantastic venues for golf in the entire country should be in its infant stages. If everything goes as planned, Landman Golf Club, located in the hills just north of Homer, Nebraska, will open in the summer of 2021. The inspiration for the breathtaking 18-hole layout came from the Anderson family of Dakota City, who built Old Dane, a popular 9-hole course near here, in 2012. Landman, pronounced Landman, is Danish for farmer, and it's spelled L-A-N-D-M-A-N-D. And the Andersons' long history of farming had a lot to do with the course that indeed could be called a farmer golf club. We had the piece of property that the golf course is going to go on, and it sat there forever, over 30 years, in the CRP program, which is the Crop Reserve Program, said Will Anderson, who, along with his father Bryce, began discussing the possibility of building another course in 2015. It's just pasture ground. There's no trees on them because my grandfather removed all of them in the 1970s and early 1980s. It just sat there, and I said to my dad, that area up there would be a cool spot to have a golf course. In order to get the land into the Crop Reserve Program, it had to be farmed for the 3 years, which, according to Bryce Anderson, were some of the toughest times he could remember. He wasn't about to farm it anymore, so I told him we could try to figure out something, Anderson said. One thing led to another, and Mitch Merrill, the head pro at Sioux City Country Club, was the first person I told we were maybe thinking about doing a golf course. Merrill put the Andersons in contact with course designer Scott Miller, who met with the Andersons and made a trip from Arizona in January of 2015 to work on routing the course. The Andersons liked his idea, however. They weren't ready to pull the trigger at that point. Fast forward to 2018, and not much more had progressed on the golf course idea, even though Will had talked to several more designers. Then a grain elevator in South Sioux City exploded, creating massive problems for area farmers, including the Andersons. Therefore, golf course talk was basically put on the back burner. At about that same time, the piece of property came out of CRP, and the Andersons had a decision to make. I told my dad if we put it back into CRP, it has to be in there for 10 years. And he said, I don't think we're going to be doing anything soon because of what's happened this year, Anderson recalled. So lo and behold, when 2019 rolled around, I randomly mentioned to him in April that it was kind of now or never. So either we do it or we don't. He just looked at me and said, you find a designer and we'll do it this year. That's when the ball really got rolling. During a round of golf at Old Dane with a friend, the friend mentioned King Collins Golf Design, which is one of the hottest names in the golf industry. King Collins is most known for their work at Sweetens Cove Golf Club in Tennessee. They turned a normal 9-hole course into one of the most talked about designs and more popular destinations in the United States. How popular is Sweetens Cove? Peyton Manning and Andy Roddick, to name a few, are among the investors. When CJ brought them up, I randomly looked at him and said I would get on my phone and email them, Anderson said. I sent them a pretty basic email explaining our situation. The next morning, I get a call from Rob Collins. 2 weeks later, Collins and Tad King traveled to Nebraska and fell in love with what they saw. We were pretty familiar with that side of the state, the Sandhills, but neither one of us had spent much time over here, Collins told the Nebraska Golfer magazine. When we got up in the hills up there, it was really quite jaw-dropping. It's got a little bit of the Sandhills look to it. Looks like Lynx course in Ireland or the Sandhills. It's just very raw, natural, tumbling landscape. After their initial trip, Collins and King returned 2 weeks later and quickly had the course routed. It literally took them a day and a half to finish routing all of the 18 holes. The holes, they said, were falling into place as they were driving and walking around the property. That's how perfect this piece of land was. The part they like the best about the golf course is that it reveals itself everywhere, Anderson said. You will get on a hole 2T and see a bunch of golf holes you're going to see at some point from a distance. Landman will play around 7,100 yards from the back tees with a par of 73. The greens will measure from 2,500 square feet on a par 3 eighth hole to 40,000 square feet on the 310-yard par 4 17th hole. Interestingly, the longest walk from any tee to green will be 65 yards. Everyone likes golf carts, but the course will still be quite walkable. There will be 5 par 5s and 4 par 3s, with all the rest par 4s. A couple of the par 4s will be drivable for longer hitters, and that par 3s will range from 240 to 110 yards. Landman will be strictly public play course with no corporate outing. I want people to be able to call up, get a tee time, and not have to worry about leagues or a scramble being out there, Anderson said. Fees will be reasonable. Anyone living within a 50-mile radius can play for $75, which includes a cart. Outside of the 50-mile radius, and the fee will be $100. Collins and King have enlisted an impressive crew to build Landman. That includes Jeff Bradley, the main bunker designer for Ben Crenshaw's courses, along with Mark Berger, who shaped Blue Jack National Course with Tiger Woods. I want a fun, exciting golf course that Sioux City has never seen, said Anderson, himself an accomplished player. Hopefully people will come from long distances to play. I want something everyone can enjoy, from the 30 handicap to the 0 handicap. Some more sports news here. Kirk Ferentz says the Hawkeyes are on the clock. Although the opponent remains unknown, Iowa football coach Kirk Ferentz said Thursday he already feels like the countdown to kickoff has started. We don't have any wiggle room for a bad day, Ferentz said during a video conference. We have to make every play and every snap count. It will be a matter of maximizing what you can do. The Hawkeyes' delayed 2020 season will begin in 5 weeks, first of 8 regular season games scheduled for all Big Ten teams on the weekend of October 23rd. Director of Athletics Gary Barta said the Iowa schedule, as well as those for all Big Ten teams, remains a work in progress as conversations with the conference's television partners continue. Barta did say he expects the possibility of Big Ten teams being involved in more Friday night games and more primetime games than in past years when the league schedule is unveiled in upcoming days. Ferentz is simply satisfied knowing that a team that began its off-season training in January finally has a season to work toward. He said, delivering the news Wednesday that the Big Ten Council of Presidents and Chancellors had approved plans to play football this fall, and that it was one of the more enjoyable sessions he has had with his Iowa football team. It's good to be talking football. There's been some uncertainty for everyone going back to March, Ferentz said. It was good to get some clarity where we're going as a football conference. It was exciting for our players. Ferentz said the announcement created a whole different vibe for everybody. The Hawkeyes will have an entirely different approach on the practice field beginning next week. With plans for a season in place, the Hawkeyes are now allowed 20 hours of practice time each week, up from the 12 hours they have been limited to since the start of fall semester classes on August 24th. On September 30th, the same date that a standardized required testing regimen for the coronavirus begins for all Big Ten teams, Iowa football players will put on pads for the first time since December 27th, when the Hawkeyes routed USC 49-24 in the Holiday Bowl. He said the situation will create a different starting point for this Iowa team. We have some challenges from a football standpoint, Ferentz said. We have a short amount of time. We'll have to maximize every opportunity. While Iowa does less contact work in practices now than it did early in Ferentz's 22-year tenure, the physical part of the game is still something the Hawkeyes will work on and prepare for, even in a coronavirus-impacted world. You can't play this game sitting in a chair, Ferentz said, saying the exact amount of contact work that will take place is still being figured out as plans are formalized. The heavy-duty workload will likely be less than in a normal fall camp setting, as coaches are cognizant of soft tissue injuries that may be more prevalent because of how everything has been structured this year. We'll do what is best for the team and try to get them ready to play, Ferentz said. Everybody is working with the same guidelines. The challenges we have are the same challenges 13 other schools are facing right now. Ferentz said a very small number of Hawkeyes may choose to opt out of the current season. There have been some concerns expressed, but there are no formal announcements to make at this point, Ferentz said. Ferentz expects the 2020 season to be different in so many ways, extending beyond the shortened schedule, the delayed start, and myriad of medical protocols surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic. That includes playing games without fans in the stands, something he has mixed feelings about. On the road, that's great. At home, it will feel kind of weird, Ferentz said. Normally at Kinnick, you come out of the tunnel and experience the swarm with all those fans. You'll miss that. It will be an adjustment. While there will be no fans in the stands at Kinnick Stadium this season, Ferentz did say that one tradition will continue. Players and game officials will take time at the end of the first quarter of the Hawkeyes' four games to participate in the Kinnick Wave, waving to patients at the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital, which is located just across the street from the stadium. Well, here's an interesting feature. The Sioux City Journal has compiled by a reader vote, Siouxland's top 50 restaurants. And this is written by Earl Horlick. When was the last time you went to a restaurant? Before COVID-19, that wasn't such a tough question to answer. Last year, we asked Journal Online readers to let us know where's a good place to eat or which place is always dependable. The suggested eateries, everything from fine dining joints to holes in the wall, were named Siouxland's top 50 restaurants. Then in March of this year, some restaurants were forced to reinvent themselves in order to stem the tide of COVID-19. Other restaurants simply had to close their doors, waiting things out when Governor Kim Reynolds lifted Iowa's statewide emergency months later. This summer, we asked online readers the same question we did last year. Where is a good place to eat and which place is dependable? While we do have some repeaters, he also gave us a bunch of new recommendations. Out of all the industries impacted by coronavirus, restaurants are among the hardest hit. Peruse these pages to see if your favorite restaurant made the cut. If it did, stop by and grab something to go. Perhaps you'll find new suggestions in this section. Patronize them as well. So here we go. The Asian or ethnic restaurant list includes Da Kao, Diamond Thai, Golden Bowl, Hu Hot Mongolian Grill, Ichiban Japanese Steakhouse, Mateo Feel American Kitchen Catering, and Koi Sushi Sushi and Steakhouse. And that one is the editor's choice. You'll find it at 1790 Hamilton Boulevard. The blurb says, we eat with our eyes as well as our stomachs. Koi Sushi and Steakhouse's artisan sushi chefs make food as pretty as a picture, but also delicious enough for you to gobble it up in one bite. Take our advice. Don't forget Koi's awesome chicken, steak, and shrimp meals cooked to perfection on a hibachi grill. Plus, they get bento box lunches for gourmands on the go. And I've eaten there myself, and it is good. For dinner fare, there's Johnny Marr's Steakhouse in the Townhouse. For pub fare, Bob Rose, the point after at 2320 Transit Avenue, wins the editor's choice. For dinner fare, Harvey's Restaurant at 5307 Military Road gets the nod. Also getting an editor's choice award is Bodega 401 at 401 Pearl Street. And then the Billy Boy Drive-Thru or Fast Casual at 2328 Riverside Boulevard gets the editor's choice award. Some suggestions for Fast Casual include Greek to Me, which I can personally recommend. That's at 5714 Sunnybrook Drive, and Iowa Barbecue Company in Lamar's, Pickerman's at 1762 Hamilton Boulevard. And for fast food, they recommend Jim's Burgers at 800 Pier Street and 4030 Floyd Boulevard. Also 35th Avenue in Lamar's, and I can personally recommend Jim's as well. And then Tasty In-N-Out at 2610 Gordon Drive. Well, that does it for the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, September 18th, 2020. I've been your reader, Alan Fredergill. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thanks for listening.
This is Tom Hatton with an Irish short take from the book entitled A Culinary History of Iowa. And this article, actually it says chapter 2, is entitled Immigrants Influence Iowa's Food Traditions. Hundreds of thousands of pioneers and immigrants from many parts of Europe and beyond flocked to Iowa in the 19th and early 20th centuries in search of a better life, whether that meant economic opportunity, religious freedom, or the chance to create a utopian society. These newcomers brought a variety of unique food traditions with them and transformed Iowa's culinary history. Some immigrants, like the French Icarians, were motivated by ideological ideals when they settled in America. The new state of Iowa, specifically Adams County, became the promised land for French men and women pursuing their dream to create a communal utopian society where everyone was equal. By some accounts, their Icaria colony in southwest Iowa was the longest existing non-religious, purely communal experiment in American history. The first Icarian party arrived in Iowa in 1852. They purchased about 3,000 acres of land from the United States government at $1.25 per acre to build their new colony near Corning. Living conditions in the untamed lands of southwest Iowa were often harsh. Log houses, some without wood floors or windows, were the French settlers' only shelter against the brutal winter. Most of the Icarians' land was unfenced, unbroken prairie, and there was not one settler along the trail before they reached Icaria, according to some reports. Supplies for the colony often had to be hauled overland for hundreds of miles. Only a few basic ingredients, including milk, butter, cornbread, and bacon, formed the daily menu. As a communal society, the Icarians worked together on the farms and ate together in a communal dining hall, where evening meals were sometimes followed by music or lectures, spoken in French. Little by little, living conditions in the colony improved as the Icarians managed to establish a fairly successful agricultural enterprise. When wool prices skyrocketed with the outbreak of the Civil War, the Icarians thrived by selling wool and other supplies to the Union Army. While the war ended in 1865, trouble was brewing in the Icaria colony by the 1870s. Much of the conflict revolved around little gardens, according to an April 1921 article in the Iowa History Journal, The Pelham Pest. Earlier in the history of the Icarian community in Iowa, each family had been permitted to cultivate a little garden around their log house where flowers might be raised. Some families had planted vines and even fruit trees. Now that these plants were bearing fruit, the more radical members of the colony could not tolerate this violation of their rules against private property. The possessors of the gardens, however, clung to their little plots of ground. It wasn't much, but it was theirs. The authorities tried to settle the quarrel with a compromise. As each family moved from their log house to a new frame house, their little garden was to be given up. There would be no simple resolution to this dispute, however, which triggered open hostilities. The radicals claimed that the community had violated its constitution and announced their intent to withdraw. They also advocated an aggressive style of communism and appealed to a circuit court to revoke the charter granted to the community in 1860 on the grounds that Icaria was really a communist establishment instead of an agricultural society, as the Articles of Incorporation provided. By 1879, a group of younger progressive colony members had split from the older, more conservative members. This marked the beginning of the end for the Icarians' utopian experiment in Iowa. In 1898, members voted to end the colony. By then, it consisted mostly of elders who could no longer continue the hard work of operating the colony. The Icarian movement in America was over. The legacy of the Icarian movement endures, however. The French Icarian Colony Board of Trustees was formed in recent years and has been rebuilding the French Icarian village on a portion of original Icarian land east of Corning. The 1878 refectory communal dining hall and 1860 one-room Icaria school have been restored for tours and research. History comes to life at the French Icarian village through events like the annual Fête de Mai, Festival of Corn, which is held in the fall. The original Fête de Mai was a celebration held by the Icarians each fall after all the crops were harvested. The feast was served in the communal dining hall to everyone who came to help on the final day of corn harvest. In late September 2015, the Cresta News Advertiser promoted the French Icarian village's fourth annual Fête de Mai, which included a four-course French supper featuring flavors of the Alsace region. It's a modern taste of the French Icarian's quest for utopia in Iowa. And that was an excerpt from A Culinary History of Iowa by Darcy Doherty Malsey, and other offbeat stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.